Increased bilateral trade in two phases, made in 2022 during the Armenian Prime Minister's visit to Tehran.
According to the agreements made in 2022 and the first phase, we set a target for a trade volume of $1 billion. And now we are taking the necessary measures to increase that by threefold. In order to reach this objective, we are signing agreements that cover 19 areas of economic cooperation.
The recently signed Eurasia Free Trade Agreement is expected to facilitate the implementation of these MOUs by eliminating custom duties. So, we are on the right track.
These developments come at a time when Iran has been an anchor for peace, with sparks of tension every now and then between Armenia and Azerbaijan turning into an issue of concern. Therefore, in the big picture, these scenes could translate into measures that go beyond traditional rhetoric, encouraging stability in the region.
Iran and Armenia are taking practical steps to expand business and trade relations, taking their economic ties to the next level, at a time when these ties seem crucial to establish peace and security in the region. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers and the resistance forces. People from as far away as Saudi Arabia's Najran province joined the gathering.
We, the tribes and nobles of Najran, came here in response to the call by Abdul Malik al-Houthi to support the people of Gaza. We declare from Sana'a that we are with Ansarullah in standing against the Zionists and the Americans who are committing genocide in Gaza. All Arabs and Muslims must stand by Gaza as it is a religious, national and humanitarian duty.
The position of the Yemeni people is consistent with its leadership. They are all in one accord with Palestine and with the axis of resistance. It is necessary to act with one's heart and soul. People have come out today to express their position and steadfastness until Palestine is liberated.
The protesters condemned the Israeli aggression against Rafah on the border of Egypt and urged their armed forces to intensify naval operations in response to the regime's war crimes in Rafah. They expressed willingness to join the Yemeni armed forces and fight against those who commit horrible crimes against innocent civilians in Gaza.
All Yemenis, young and old, men and women, learn to use all types of weapons, from pistols to automatic rifles, anti-aircraft guns and missiles. Everyone is preparing for the decisive battle with the Zionists. When we declare that we are ready, it is not to brag in the media, but rather we are truly prepared to confront America, Israel and those with them.
Earlier, the spokesman for the Yemeni army stated that the forces had successfully targeted a British ship in the Gulf of Aden using naval missiles. He also pledged to continue preventing Israeli-linked vessels from sailing through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait until the Israeli genocide stops.
People here believe that it is time for Muslims around the world to unite against the Israeli enemy and its backers. They call on the people across the Arab world to take to the streets and initiate concrete actions against the Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
On the martyrdom anniversary of three prominent leaders, Hezbollah's Secretary General vowed that the resistance will retaliate for the Israeli strikes that killed civilians in South Lebanon, considering them deliberate massacres.
I tell friend and foe, the enemy will pay in blood for the bloodshed of our women and children in the last few days in Nabatea and Sawana and other towns of South Lebanon.
Analysts believe Nasrallah's words are very significant, but so is his deliberate silence on several issues.
This is the general approach with Sayyid Hassan always takes, trying to keep the enemy always in a state of psychological fear, not expecting, not being able to anticipate how the retaliation might come.
Hezbollah declared it launched a first retaliation for the massacres by launching Katyusha rockets against targets in Kiryat Shmona. But the leader of the resistance responded to the Israeli war minister Yoav Gallant's threats against Lebanon, saying the rocket capabilities of the Lebanese resistance goes beyond that.
Perhaps Gallant has forgotten that the resistance possesses a massive and precise missile power that enables it to strike Kiryat Shmona and all the way to Eilat.
He also underlined that the resistance front in the region as a whole has been able to enforce a balance of power, which bars the Israelis and the United States from achieving their goals.
He said that the Yemenis, in the action they took, did not resort to focusing on the Americans in their military operations, but rather continue to focus on Israel. And he said that that must remain the strategy. So I think that that's a very important. Sayyid Hassan continues to set realistic goals and to focus on weakening the Israeli side and not to go into some rash kind of action which could lead to strategically backfiring against the axis of resistance.
Hezbollah supporters commemorate yearly the martyrdom of Hezbollah slain Secretary General Said Abbas Mousawi, who was assassinated in an Israeli strike on the martyrdom anniversary of Sheikh Raghib Harb, a leader of the grassroots movement. Hezbollah is also commemorating the martyrdom of its top military commander, Imad Mughniyeh. The martyrdom of each of Hezbollah's leaders remembered today signaled a new stage in the resistance movement's development. Now, any miscalculation by the Israeli regime could be a turning point in Hezbollah's use of its covert capabilities. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In a press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Dayfullah Shami, spokesperson for the Yemeni government and Minister of Information, once again reiterated Yemen's stance that the U.S. presence in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden poses a real threat to international maritime navigation by militarizing international waters. As Shami stated that Washington's presence under the pretext of protecting Israeli vessels provokes the Yemeni army to continue its naval operations.
America is the source of real threats to navigation in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and the presence of its forces that came from a distance of 9,000 miles to launch an aggression against Yemen under false and blatant justifications. They are to protect the ships of the Israeli entity and support it economically and militarily, and have nothing to do with securing international navigation.
Hashemi added that the U.S. and U.K. have launched over 400 airstrikes against the Yemeni territories, resulting in the deaths of more than 40 soldiers. He asserted that neither Western aggression nor the U.S. designation of Ansarullah as a terrorist group will halt Yemen's naval operations in support of Palestinians.
The American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group is ironic. How can a terrorist classify those who defend themselves and their causes as terrorists? This designation shows U.S. no longer has any steps to take to stop Yemeni operations in support of Palestine. This classification will not affect Yemen's military operations, but may be a provocation for greater escalation.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that no Israeli-linked vessel has sailed through the Red Sea in the past weeks, describing this as a major victory. He accused the US and UK of being the real terrorists for assisting the Israeli regime in committing war crimes against the innocent people of the Gaza Strip.
Yemen's official stance is clear. The Yemeni army's naval operations will continue until the Israeli war against Gaza stops. Officials say the United States designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group will not help the US and UK achieve the objectives they failed to reach through military aggression.
Addressing women's health challenges and how they may affect the family, and particularly young children. Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Tajikistan, along with the WHO, coming together for the 28th time since 2005 to promote regional cooperation, an initiative by the Islamic Republic of Iran to improve public healthcare services.
Regional and sub-regional partnerships are crucial for effective implementation of joint regional initiatives and cross-border collaboration, and for detecting and responding to disease outbreaks and other man-made and natural disasters.
The challenges discussed in this three-day meeting will provide the groundwork for a much larger international health conference dubbed PAC for UAC, or Primary Healthcare for Universal Health Coverage, to be held right here in March.
This is the eighth time during Mr. Raisi's term in office that the G5 meeting is held. The main objective is to pinpoint the challenges that exist so that we can plan the upcoming PAC for UHC conference. The health sector of Iran has improved to a level where it can not only become a health tourism hub, but also share its valuable experiences with regional countries and help with improving health issues.
And while neighboring countries are dealing with a number of issues, they still could not turn a blind eye to the tragic situation of mothers and children in Gaza, living in dreadful conditions, now struggling to access safe water and sanitation, a basic human right.
We want healthy mothers to give birth to healthy babies, because that is the only way we can plan for the future of our societies. In Tajikistan, recently ratified laws are in line with this policy, and I hope that all women in different parts of our region can enjoy the kind of support we have in our country.
G5 Forum basically provides us an opportunity to learn from the weaknesses, from the challenges, and take a comparative disadvantage of each other from our strengths and experiences.
The ultimate goal is to provide universal health coverage and develop national roadmaps and strategies for improving healthcare services. Iran's initiative in this regard has allowed major advancements, and according to the World Health Organization, the Islamic Republic of Iran is now a role model, with its PAC, or primary healthcare network, extending beyond its borders.
These meetings will continue until February 15th, with the participants discussing the different challenges that they're facing, also paving the way for an international health conference that will be held in the Iranian capital in March. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Hezbollah's Islamic Resistance Movement has announced that it conducted a new batch of operations, with the count over 1,000. The hits recently include the targeting and destruction of espionage and technical devices in the radar post, which is situated in the occupied Lebanese Shabaab farms. We can see the occupied Lebanese Shabaab farms, where all military Israeli posts have been targeted and its hardware destroyed. Just beneath that, we can see the town of Al-Khiyam, which is subject to almost daily Israeli shelling. The resistance also declared it has used the heavy Falak 1 rocket to target the Ma'ali Golan barracks, while also targeting the Kila post in the occupied Golan Heights in retaliation for Israel's aggressions in Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Several secret headquarters, including the 91st Division in the Galilee region, and gatherings of soldiers were also under Hezbollah's fire. Experts believe the confrontation is moving in an ascending ladder of events.
The Israelis are attempting to put pressure on the resistance by changing the rules of engagement, and therefore have begun with targeted assassinations. The resistance is responding in accordance with its vision of this battle, and is ensuring that it remains limited to the border region where it has the upper hand.
Journalists and cameramen are always on high alert in case sounds of explosions are heard to get some glimpse of a battle which seems unpredictable. Yet as Israelis go further, so will the resistance. Sheikh Jihad Asadi is a resident of the southern town of Shabaab, but was forced to live further away from his town, which has been partially occupied by the Israelis since after the 1967 war. He says he keeps an eye on the Shabaab farms to watch resistance rockets hit their targets and believes it will one day be liberated.
Netanyahu says he will withdraw from Shabaab farms if Hezbollah withdraws to the north of the Litani River. We tell him that it is he who has to withdraw from occupied Lebanese land. This is the beginning of the end of the Israeli regime, and we advise all the Zionist settlers not to remain on our land, even if a truce is in place.
Hezbollah has also targeted several Israeli drones and lately hacked and confiscated an Israeli Skylark drone.
With the scope of Israeli attacks amplifying, Hezbollah is flexibly adhering to the needs of the battlefield, whether in the quality or the quantity of their hits against Israeli targets or the armaments used. Maryam Saleh from Khiyam, South Lebanon.
An emergency protest outside the UK Prime Minister's office to try and stop an imminent massacre, called for by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a coalition of other similar organizations.
Week after week, pro-Palestinian protesters have come out in huge numbers to demand that the British government call for a permanent, immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and to terminate its military and political support for apartheid Israel. And they're galvanized by the knowledge and hope that the pressure they're ramping up on the British government will eventually stir action.
In a sign of that pressure working, only hours before the protests, the UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron joined other European leaders to caution the Netanyahu regime to think twice about its mass incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which shelters 1.4 million displaced Palestinians.
We are very concerned about the situation and we want Israel to stop and think very seriously before it takes any further action. But above all, what we want is an immediate pause in the fighting. And we want that pause to lead to a ceasefire, a sustainable ceasefire, without a return to further fighting.
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
But while that may seem like a change in the UK government's tone, the protesters here say it doesn't go far enough.
What kind of disturbed and dystopian world are we in? We're asking for peace is become slander. I just do not understand. I cannot comprehend what more needs to be done. Do they need to see 1 million Gazans being exterminated on their TVs or drowning in the Mediterranean Sea? Because that is the options that Israel is giving them.
Another demand here, an end to UK arms sales to Israel. According to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, between 2015 and 2022, the UK licensed more than $500 million worth of weapons to Tel Aviv. Saeed Pourreza, London.
It's a day off for Zayed, a computer science student in New Delhi, hailing from neighboring Uttar Pradesh state. He wants to pursue a career in New Delhi, saying finding job is like a battle in this part of the world. But he is disappointed with the fact that elections are due and nothing more is important for politicians rather than stoking religious sentiments.
The governments have their own agendas to stay in power and they want to win over and over again. So the easy tool is to exploit people on the issue of faith. India's people from all faiths and the politicians want us to stay uneducated. So we won't question them on their policies. We should be talking about education, unemployment, healthcare and good future for our next generation.
After the opening of a major Hindu temple in the town of Ayodhya last month, anti-Muslim sentiments are running high in India. In the Himalayan state of Uttarakhand, the demolition of a decades-old mosque and its seminary has led to deadly clashes. The violence is the latest incident of communal flare-up ahead of general elections. Muslim sites have become a new target of the right-wing Hindu groups. In recent weeks, top Muslim leaders urged the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi to end the religious dispute, citing a threat to communal harmony and calling for the protection of Muslim places of worship.
Since the BJP rule started in 2014, they are doing everything to destroy the country's secular credential. They are taking the country in the wrong direction by promoting Hindu first agenda to patronize the majority. But this country has a constitution which we trust and believe in. They raised a mosque in New Delhi last week, now in Haldwani, calling them illegal encroachment despite the fact they are decades old. They are selectively targeting a particular community, which is very unfortunate.
Experts say the demolitions are not confined to any particular region or state, but a deliberate attempt to demonize the Muslim community. Meanwhile, tensions have gripped the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh, Bareilly city, after the arrest of an Islamic cleric who had called for protests against the demolition of the mosque. Human rights groups have called on the Indian government to halt this bulldozer campaign. Critics accuse the Modi's government of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege the ruling party is stigmatizing its critics and adopting policies that legitimize violence against the religious minorities. The BJP denies the claims, saying equal rights for all is enshrined in Indian democracy.
General elections in India are due in May 2024. Observers say many polarizing issues, including those related to Muslims, are being hyped in both social and political domain to garner public attention in the Hindu-majority India, where religion is used for electoral gains. Rights groups have accused the ruling BJP of selectively targeting Muslims, their homes, places of worship and businesses, calling it a larger political agenda. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key with Sheikh Rouhani on RIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Thumma salatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-Tahirin. Dear and respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. In this program of The Key, we are going to explain some Quranic proofs and arguments to prove the asma or the infallibility of the imam. Because in the previous episode, we explained the meaning and the definition of infallibility and then the rational proofs. Now we are going to mention some of the ayat by which we can prove that the imam and the leader of the nation and the ummah of Islam should be immune from any kind of error and mistakes. In the Holy Quran, we read this in this ayah that أَفَمَنْ يَهْدِي إِلَى الْحَقِّ أَحَقُّ أَن يُتَّبَعَ أَمَّنْ لَا يَهْدِي إِلَى أَن يُهْدَى فَمَا لَكُمْ كَيْفَ تَحْكُمُونَ. In this ayah, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explicitly says that, is he who guides to the truth worthier to be followed, or he who guides not unless he is guided? What is the matter with you? How do you guide? So of course, in this ayah says that the one who needs to be guided cannot be the guide. The one who is of no need to guide, I mean that he himself is already guided, this one can be the one who can guide the ummah and the nation of the Prophet ﷺ from the hellfires. That's why in this verse, the guidance of a person who is not in need of the guidance of others is compared with that of a person who acquires guidance from others. And the guidance of the first is considered superior and necessary to follow. So it is evident that one would not be in need of the guidance of others if he receives, for example, a special guidance from God. And he is one of the divinely, let's say, elect. So that's why in this ayah it is very explicitly mentioned that the one who guides the people, himself must be guided by a kind of special blessing of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it is worth mentioning that the word haqqu means worthier in this ayah. in this verse actually does not only indicate the superiority of the following the guidance of the Ma'asum, but also implies the necessity for it, as attested by the fact that at the beginning of the verse, that guidance of God has been compared to that of what the polytheists recognize to be partner of God. So that's why in this ayah of the Holy Quran, we very clearly see that the need for isma is something very much it's like a must that a guide and an imam and a leader must be actually ma'asum and immune from actually sins and errors. So one of the actually proofs that substantiate a religious society's need for an imam is that in knowing the religion and action upon it, the people are not immune from error. So therefore, if the imam is also not immune from the error or mistake, then he will be actually in need for another imam. So seeking of the second imam, if he actually is also not infallible, another imam will also need it. If we continue this, of course, we see that we finally find no one. We will end up in a kind of vicious cycle. So therefore, it is evident that there must be always a guide and an immune person from any kind of mistake and error for the guidance of the ummah and the people. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Rouhani in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. It's been more than 4 months since Israel started its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Nearly 28,000 Palestinians have lost their lives and about 70,000 others have been injured. Most of the population in the besieged territory have been forced to move to the southern city of Rafah. Now Israel is preparing to invade Palestinians' last refuge in the south of the Gaza Strip. The UN has warned of a bloodbath if Israel invades the city. Where else do Palestinians have to go? And will there ever be an end to the decades-long Western-backed occupation and genocide against the Palestinian people? We'll try to find out in tonight's Spotlight with our guests. Former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Mr. Scott Ritter, who's joining us from Bethlehem, New York. And also joining us from Brussels, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ritter. After 133 days of Israeli terror, nearly 29,000 Palestinians have been killed. Most of them, of course, women and children in Gaza. The Israeli military has also raided the main hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The UN Rights Office says Israeli raids systematically target life-saving infrastructure, especially hospitals. Please share with us your perspective on this genocide that is unfolding in Gaza before our very eyes.
Well, first of all, we need to reflect on the fact that nobody's stepping up to stop this. Nobody. Not the United States, who should be, because we're the nation that has the ability to put the most pressure on Israel. Not Europe. Not Asia, not Russia, not China, not Egypt, not Jordan, not Syria, not Saudi Arabia. Nobody is stepping up to stop this. And we just have to accept this reality, that whatever's happening right now is apparently not of sufficient horror, not a big enough tragedy to cause the moral compass of these nations to be altered. Which means that any talk today of a Palestinian state is empty talk, because you can't have a Palestinian state if you don't respect the Palestinian people. So we have to reflect on another reality, that at this point in time, the Israeli military has acknowledged that the goal and objective of the military defeat of Hamas has failed, that it's not going to happen. So this is a conflict that will continue, and the Palestinian people will continue, until which time either Israel is able to eventually wear down Hamas and defeat them, or the international community becomes so outraged by the depravity of the Israelis when it comes to the genocide, the war crimes they've committed, that there can be a push on the part of the international community to bring this war to an end. But right now, unfortunately, people with a heart are crying when they see the images of the babies, but no government has fundamentally changed its position. And so I think we're looking at continued violence for some point.
Okay, hold that thought. I'm going to come back to you in a minute, Mr. Ritter. Elijah Magnier, Israel is bombing areas of Gaza that it has designated as safe, wiping out entire families. And now it's planning a ground offensive in Rafah, which is holding more than half of the population of Gaza. Officials in Cairo have already opposed calls to take in Palestinians in case they flee Rafah. The north of Gaza has been flattened. Another war crime is looming in the south. Where are Gazans supposed to go? EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell asked, are Gazans supposed to evacuate to the moon?
Well, Josep Borrell is right, because he was pointing out that the people in Gaza have no other place to go because there are no safe places in Gaza. Now, I don't think this is a bad idea for the Palestinians to remain in Rafah, because if they are forced to flee to Egypt, then this is another exodus, and this is exactly where Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, wants them to be, to make sure that he can exterminate all those who remain in Gaza and consider them all as potential targets. Now, at the moment, the Palestinian resistance is still fighting back in the north, is still firing missiles from the north, it is still fighting in Khan Yunis, and is preparing itself in Rafah. On the other hand, there are the axis of the resistance on the front with Lebanon, the Iraqis, and the Yemeni are also participating. And as far as we know, that the axis of the resistance is not going to allow Israel to defeat the Palestinians. So we understand that the potentiality of an escalation is on the table today, because Benjamin Netanyahu is determined to continue the war. He's not listening to anyone, because he wants to remain in power, and he is supported by the Israeli far-right ministers. So for that, the only hope of the Palestinians is to stand and fight. And I understand that there are many civilians who are paying the price, but they have been paying the price since 1930. And if we want to look at the current history from the beginning of this war in the 7th of October, Israel did everything to destroy everything possible in Gaza and to render the city impossible to live after the war. So basically, it's not going to change anything, and it would be much better for the Palestinians not to leave and for Egypt not to open the gate and play in Netanyahu's hands.
Right. Scott Ritter, is Israel using the excuse of eradicating Hamas, something that you also pointed out it has failed to achieve, to just to continue to kill Palestinians? The Israeli Prime Minister's insistence on continuing the onslaught and rejecting any ceasefires basically shows his goal is genocide against Palestinians. In continuation to that, what you mentioned in your first answer, you said that no government is stepping up. Why is that?
Because the Palestinian cause hasn't generated, it doesn't resonate amongst anybody outside of Palestine. Let's be honest. Egypt has never articulated adequately for a Palestinian state. Egypt enjoys the status quo ante. They receive significant money from the United States that's linked to the money that we give to Israel. So they, you know, if you create a Palestinian state and it's premised on the notion of peaceful coexistence with Israel, if peace breaks out all over, there might be a recalibration of this aid to Egypt. Syria hasn't done a good job of standing up for a Palestinian state. Jordan hasn't. Jordan fears the Palestinians. The only ones who have done anything meaningful at this point in time is Hezbollah in Lebanon. But Hezbollah is a political party, not just a resistance movement.
Let's
and they have
Yemen
a responsibility
as well.
To Lebanon.
Let's not forget Yemen.
Well, Yemen is the sole exception right now. But the Yemeni response is limited. They have the ability to interdict shipping, and Israel's paying a very heavy economic price, and so is Europe, but it's not a game-changing price. What the Yemenis are doing is a harassment. It's an inconvenience, but it's not enough to drive Israel to its knees. Now, if Yemen were able to get some of Iran's hypersonic missiles and start attacking Israeli cities, maybe we'd have a different outcome. Or maybe if Hezbollah unleashed some of its arsenal against Israeli cities, we'd have a different outcome. But right now, the heroism of the Yemenis isn't enough to change the outcome, and Hezbollah doesn't look like it's ready to step up and engage in full-scale war with Israel. And until that happens, Israel will operate with a free hand against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Elijah Magni, U.S. President Joe Biden recently said the Israelis have gone over the top regarding the assault on Gaza. One must ask, how far is too far in the support that Washington is giving the Israelis and the massacre that the Israeli regime is committing? The EU foreign policy chief once again said, if you're concerned with the civilian deaths to the U.S., then stop supplying them with arms.
Actually, the U.S. is concerned about the number of the civilians that is not arguing killing the civilians, but is saying over the top, because Israel was killing between 450 and 500 Palestinians every day, of which 70% are children and women. So what the Americans are saying is they don't want to a permanent ceasefire. They don't want to stop this war, but they want Netanyahu to kill less civilians and less children and women, but to continue his war and to negotiate to free the prisoners and then to return to war and to fight against the Palestinian resistance until he defeat them, when his own generals are saying Hamas is an ideology. The Palestinian resistance cannot be defeated, and it can be weakened only. So there is a very clear indication from the United States and Europe that they don't want the end of the war. They're trying to bring humanitarian aid because that suits them for their own peace of mind, to say we're doing something for the civilians, but they're not managing, because less than 140 trucks are going in Gaza every day, some days 40, some days 50, and nothing is going to the north of Gaza of humanitarian aid for the last 14 to 16 days, which means that there are all the violations of international laws. The ICJ is starting on Monday, and Israel has not complied because it is unaccountable and because it is enjoying the full support of the United States at the United Nations in supplying weapons and covering all the Israeli crimes and sending them money. So this is why Israel are on leash and they think they can do anything.
Scott Ritter, Iran's foreign minister, has said that Israel wants to drag the U.S. alongside itself into the quote-unquote West Asia quagmire. Do you believe the Israelis are seeking to expand their onslaught on Gaza into a wider regional conflict so they can get the U.S. directly involved? And if so, are these actions producing the results that the Israelis are seeking?
I think Benjamin Netanyahu has articulated in the past that he would like to see robust military action against Iran for the purpose of eliminating Iran's nuclear infrastructure. He recognizes that he could only do this if the United States went along. But that's a different problem that's being faced right now. I don't believe the Israelis want to expand this conflict because, for instance, if Hezbollah ever meaningfully engaged, meaning not the managed conflict, but a full-scale conflict, Israel would lose. Israel would lose Galilee. There's a chance Israel would lose the Golan Heights. And the Israeli generals know this. So they want to maintain pressure, the threat of a regional conflict, as a way of distracting American diplomatic efforts. But their focus is on resolving the crisis in Gaza. And as your other guest pointed out, look, they're in the business of killing Palestinians and nobody's stopping them. Nobody cares about the Palestinian people right now. The International Court of Justice's ruling is meaningless because nobody's stepping up. The only way the United States can disentangle itself is if the price paid for continuing to support Israel is greater than the price that they meaning that if the international community starts to hold the United States accountable, that maybe the United States will realize that supporting Israel is a losing proposition. But at this point in time, the United States isn't paying that price. And unfortunately, I think it's going to be the Palestinian people that continue to suffer.
Elijah Magni, a few minutes earlier, we were talking about Yemen and the response that they've given to the genocide in Gaza, also the response they've given against American and British ships to the ongoing strikes on Yemen. Talk to us about the Yemeni response to the Gaza onslaught, how you view it, and also the defiant message that they've been sending to the U.S. and its allies so far.
The Yemeni have done an incredible work from the beginning of this war. They tried to bomb the Israelis in support of Gaza, but they were faced with the American and their allies' interception missiles on the way. So what they have done is they found out that it is better to block the Israeli shipments and prevent Israel from having it in the same way like nothing had happened during this war and suffer a little bit, even if Gaza is suffering even more, and always in the name of Gaza, because the Yemeni were very careful in not diverting the attention on the Palestinian cause. Now they step up even further when the Americans and the British started bombing Yemen. And the British and the Americans didn't learn that the Yemen for 7 years was under the bombardment and was never flexible. So what the Yemeni are doing is by targeting all the American, the British, and the Israeli ships, they are imposing a new rule of engagement on the Bab al-Mandeb, and they have promised to increase that. And I think the way they promised to increase is directly linked to the Israeli plans to go into Rafah and to force another exodus of the Palestinians either toward Egypt or toward the north of Gaza or along the sea, as Netanyahu is thinking of doing. So this is why I said from the beginning, Gaza is not going to be left alone and the Palestinians are not going to be left to the mercy of Benjamin Netanyahu. and the most immoral army in the world, that is the Israeli occupation forces, because Iraq and Yemen will increase the pace, and Hezbollah is already starting to use a higher caliber. So I think Yemen can do a lot by showing the world that the simplest way to stop the interruption of the navigation of the Israeli shipments and the Americans and the British is to stop the war on Gaza. Unfortunately, there is not enough will of the international community to stop the war, and Netanyahu is not listening to anyone, and the Americans are not willing to commit a political suicide by stopping the support to Israel. Therefore, it is up to the axis of the resistance, mainly Yemen, because it proves very efficient, and because also the front of Lebanon is still within a controlled area and is not destined to expand, depending on what's happening on the ground in Gaza. Therefore, Yemen will find something new, and I'm sure something will come up in the next weeks, but we haven't seen yet Netanyahu implementing his plan to force an exodus, because he's still fighting in the north and he's still fighting in the south, and the war is not over in these areas, as he is lying to his people and saying, I'm going to move to another stage and go to Rafah because this is the last point.
Okay.
All the casualties that he's suffering are in the area that he claimed to occupy but not control.
Scott Ritter, there was a recent U.S. drone attack on the capital Baghdad, Iraqi capital Baghdad. Iraq, of course, condemned that, calling it a breach of their sovereignty. An Iraqi resistance movement following that drone attack called for submitting a request to the UN Security Council to demand the immediate withdrawal of foreign forces. The Iraqi Prime Minister also stated that Baghdad wants a quick withdrawal of the destabilizing U.S. forces from Iraq. What do you think are the motives behind the United States' recent attacks on resistance groups in Iraq?
Well, the motive is to make what the United States calls pro-Iranian proxies pay a price for the sin of launching a drone strike on Tower 22, killing three Americans, wounding several others. You know, the goal is to create a sense of deterrence, to imbue the pro-Iranian militias in Iraq with fear that the consequences they will pay for striking American targets will be greater than any benefit they gain from that. You know, let's just be clear. Taking a case to the Security Council is meaningless, given that the United States has a veto. So that's just a political gesture. And the Prime Minister can say all he wants about his desire to remove troops, but the United States has disregarded Iraqi political threats of this in the past. The only way the United States is going to withdraw is if the price they pay is intolerably high. And we'll find out how serious the Iraqi militias are. If they continue to do the pinprick attacks, then nothing will change. The only way this changes is with full-scale onslaughts that threaten American bases in Iraq with being overrun and massive casualties. At that point in time, the United States will make a determination that the price being paid to maintain a presence in Iraq is too great, and they'll withdraw. But that isn't going to happen until Iraq steps up to the plate and physically threatens the American troops present on their ground. And right now, I don't see the political will in Iraq to do that.
Mr. Magni, in Brussels last month, the U.S., along with a dozen countries, of course, mostly Western states, suspended funds to UNRWA. That's the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees. What was your initial reaction to hearing this decision? And also, what consequences will this move have for the population in need of assistance in Gaza right now?
It is very unfortunate because Israel has been aiming to defund UNRWA for a very long time. And what is most unfortunate is not the defunding. It is the narrative that the Israeli intelligence is offering to the world leaders and saying that there are 12 to 13 Palestinians who are part of Hamas and in UNRWA, and then condemn the millions of Palestinians who receive support from the United Nations Refugee Organization in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria, and in Palestine. So condemning all these people doesn't really come from a narrative from the Israelis or a lie, saying without offering any proof that to the confession of the American leaders and all the European leaders, even the United Nations who fired or suspended the 12 employee or 13, without any proof, they admit that, and yet they are submitted to the Israeli will to suspend the funds on UNRWA and force the Palestinians to leave Gaza. In fact, the only objective of the Israeli government, led by the extremist Benjamin Netanyahu and all his gang, is to expel all the Palestinians, but not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, because the funding UNRWA in the West Bank is putting really all the Palestinians in trouble. And we're talking about 5 to 6 million Palestinians living in Palestine today that are living only on the support of the United Nations. And if you look at Gaza, is made of dozens of refugee camps from Palestinians who came from all over Palestine during the 1948 Exodus and later on. So this malicious step aims again to give another hit to the Palestinians, but it's a direct message from the Israelis that the Palestinians need to understand that the Israelis will never want to live with them. This is why the Palestinians can only stick to one thing, is the armed resistance to fight for their land. And I think this is what they are doing. And this is what the 7th of October offered for them as the only remaining choice.
Sure. One last question for Mr. Ritter. You mentioned earlier that governments aren't stepping up to the plate, but it's been the exact opposite with regards to the people, to the public, where just recently crowds in Jordan took to the streets of Amman in solidarity with Palestinians. They're protesting against the kingdom's continuation of exports of produce and vegetables and fruits to Israel. Similar demonstrations, of course, have been ongoing since the start of the Israeli onslaught in cities around the world. Do you think that this is the most isolated Israel has ever been because of this genocidal war?
I think in terms of global public opinion, yes. There's no doubt that the vast majority of the people around the world oppose what Israel is doing, and they oppose it vociferously. The problem is how to take this opposition and turn it into something that's politically meaningful, because the political and economic elites that are making policy, that continue to advocate in support of Israel, aren't moving. They're not being moved off of their position. And so, you know, this public outrage hasn't found the leverage necessary to get political outcomes. And until it does, it's meaningless, because